From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich has studied her share of history's heroines, women she calls Amazon women, like the suffragist Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the novelist Virginia Woolf. But she's also spent much of her career teasing out the micro-histories of women who aren't on the radar of history, women whose experience is often considered trivial and unimportant. But Ulrich argues these accounts matter. The diaries and letters of ordinary women tell personal stories, but also illuminate social trends of the past and help explain culture today. Today on the program, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich joins us to talk about how and why people want to be remembered. Plus, faith and doubt with the Book of Mormon girl, Joanna Brooks. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Whether initials carved into a tree or a message on a gravestone, humans want to leave a mark on the world, some kind of evidence that they existed. The historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich has studied the many ways early American women used diaries, quilts, and other mementos to mark the passage of time. And today on the program, Ulrich joins us to talk about the importance of micro-histories and how women are remembered in history. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is the 300th anniversary university professor at Harvard University. She's a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Grant, as well as a former president of the American Historical Association. She's the author of several books, including Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History and A Midwife's Tale, which won the Pulitzer Prize in History. And Laurel Thatcher Ulrich joins me here in studio. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, thanks so much for your time. Good morning.
I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Ulrich will deliver the Sterling M. McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture, titled Remember Me, the Inscription of Self in 19th Century Mormonism. That's happening tomorrow night, August 24th at 7 o'clock, right here at the Salt Lake City Main Library. The lecture is sponsored by the Tanner Humanities Center at the University of Utah, and it's free and open to the public. And you can also listen to the lecture live here on KCPW, or you can stream it on our website, kcpw.org. She'll also be part of a panel discussion on Saturday titled Latter-day Saint Women and Agency, a Historical Perspective. It's part of the Women and the LDS Church Conference at Fort Douglas at the University of Utah. That event is also free and open to the public. You don't have to register, but there is more information on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, progressive Mormon Joanna Brooks will be with us to talk about her new memoir, The Book of Mormon Girl. But first, women and history. Why do you keep a journal of your day-to-day activities or compile favorite poems? I mean, what do you hope will become of these records? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, you're widely known as the woman who coined this phrase, well-behaved women seldom make history. I understand you were a grad student writing about Puritan funeral services, of all things, and this phrase was part of an early publication. And of course, since then, the motto has gone global. It's all over T-shirts and mugs and bumper stickers. I mean, what do you make of how this slogan has been adopted and evolved?
Oh, it's fascinating. In fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book several years ago, 3, 4, or 5 years ago with that name, is I was just so amazed at the variant ways this had been used by all kinds of groups. And I would get fan mail. You know, I've written...
You're a historian.
I'm a historian. I've written lots of books, but I will never have as much fan mail as I have from that one sentence, which I kind of dropped rather casually. So the thing that's interesting about it, I think, is it kind of sat there in a scholarly journal until somebody discovered it and put it on the internet. I mean, this is an example of the explosion of communication come through computers and digital forms.
So this wasn't a call to action. What was your original intent with the phrase?
Well, my original intent, I was reacting to the mode of writing about women, which they weren't worth writing about unless they were, in my field, witches, basically. I mean, I worked
on... You specialize in early American
Early
history.
America, 17th century. So the only women that got mentioned were the ones who got in trouble in some way. And I thought, there might be more there to think about. And so I just tossed off, you know, well-behaved women seldom make history. But actually... there's a very serious point to be made there, and that is, unless people leave records, there is no history. Historians can't make it up. We have to base it on something that's left behind. And sad but true, very few women left records.
Your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Midwife's Tale, it details 27 years of journal entries from a midwife in New England.
Yes.
Her name, Martha Ballard. How did you find her journal, first of all?
I was working on another project. It took me to the Maine State Library and couldn't find what I was looking for and thought, what else have they got here? And I was just stunned. This diary begins in 1785, but Martha Ballard was 50 years old by that time. So she's an older woman writing just after the American Revolution. And it's actually one of the earliest surviving detailed diaries from a woman in what is now the United States. And it was especially important because she was a midwife and a healer. So it really transformed my understanding, and I think that of many readers, of early American healthcare.
And yet it was tossed aside. It was back in the archives. Other historians didn't pay any attention to it. I mean, what drew you to this? I mean, if you look on the face of it, it's a very ordinary document.
Right. Well, it was in Maine, for one thing. And historians tend to hang out in, you know, more prestigious archives. They don't necessarily go to the hinterland to look for sources. It was ordinary. And I think, you know, it goes back to my earlier point. People look for drama. And there's the kind of stereotype of women, if they're well-behaved, they're invisible. And if they're not, they're really, really bad. And then it becomes a fun story. And it was, for me, a kind of mission in my scholarship to get beneath that dichotomy of the good, bad woman and try to get at the texture and details of people's lives and to recognize women have a history. It's not some kind of unchanging, relentless saga that repeats itself over and over for millennia. There's a history there, and it's important that we understand it.
In the book, you write about entries that are as mundane as laundry entries, and things that you were able to glean with outside sources that sort of illuminated the economic health of the family, when she had help in the house. I mean,
yes.
Those entries really required you to read between the lines in many ways.
Well, they required me to discover patterns. So if Martha doesn't mention wash day, it's because she wasn't doing the washing. And by discovering the pattern, discovering, it's a little smoky in Utah right
now. It sure is.
I've got a frog in my throat. Sorry. But discovering the pattern of her record keeping and then tracing who was actually in the house at various points, you know, I realized a lot about the organization of the household economy.
Hmm. We're speaking with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, the historian, professor of history at Harvard University. She'll be delivering the Sterling M. McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture tomorrow night, August 24th at 7 o'clock, right here at the Salt Lake City Main Library. You can either join us in the auditorium or listen to it live here on KCPW or stream it at kcpw.org. If you've got questions or comments about record keeping, about women in history, about early Mormon record keeping and what that means for the culture today of today's Mormon women, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You were raised in Sugar City, Idaho. It's a very small town in Idaho. Did your undergraduate work here at the University of Utah. And I understand you wanted to be a writer since fifth grade. So pretty early on, you decided that you wanted to be in the creative arts. Did your small town roots somehow inform how you approach history, how you look at your research, maybe in a different way from somebody who lived in or grew up in an urban setting?
Well, probably. You know, I didn't really think about that, but when I was working on a documentary film based on a midwife's tale, the producer was just relentless in trying to figure out where this interest came from in, you know, this old lady delivering babies up in rural Maine. And as I thought about it, I think it was because I grew up in a small town, but not just that. I grew up with stories about pioneers, stories from my grandparents, stories from my mother. I think the first job I had when I was in college during summer, I came home and I worked for the local newspaper interviewing the old timers. And my mother knew all these people, and she'd tell me, go talk to so-and-so, you know. And I was an English major. I was reading fine literature. It was later that I came to history, and I think some of that imprint from my childhood came to the fore, and I thought, these people are interesting. Hmm. They're not boring. They're not insignificant. They're interesting people.
So if they're so interesting, I mean, why aren't more historians studying the ordinary lives, the mundane in day in and day out accounts of early Americans, do you think?
Well, they are. Actually, when I came into the field of history in the early 70s, social history was the domain of historians, although records are the problem.
And explain what social history is for those.
Social history is studying the common, ordinary people, the broad structures of society, rather than presidents and, you know, famous writers.
Looking at trends.
And a lot of that was quantitative. So you could get census records, and you could look at an entire community. And I did a lot of that with The Midwife's Tale, trying to situate her in her town, where were they economically, and so on. But that kind of social history, quantitative social history, doesn't always provide interesting stories. And to have personal records is just a great gift to a historian. But lots of those records are left by men. So the problem with women's history is looking at different kinds of sources. Women left a lot of evidence behind, but it might be, you know, a scrapbook with locks of hair in it collected from friends or relatives. It might be an autograph album. It might be a quilt. It might be an embroidered sampler. It might be a name brilliantly painted on the side of a chest or a cupboard. And so that interest in finding women's records took me into the field, you know, scholars call material culture, but the study of artifacts and the use of non-traditional sources for recovering women's lives.
I read a lecture that you delivered that talked about a quilt, a single quilt, and how, you know, it could easily be disregarded as, oh, that's beautiful, oh, the thread of a certain time. But you were able to deconstruct that quilt in a very historically significant way. I mean, even one single artifact can illuminate a certain point in time.
Absolutely. And that quilt has actually led me in part into my new project on 19th century Mormons. The quilt was discovered and written about first by Carol Nielsen, a local Salt Lake City woman, volunteer at the Pioneer Memorial Museum. And it was in her family, and the University of Utah published her book on the quilt. And I immediately contacted her and said, this is fabulous. You know, there's more that could be done with this. And so with her permission, I created this presidential address for the American Historical Association. I kind of wanted to blow people's minds a bit. Here you are talking to a group of historians. Hey, let's talk about a quilt. And I think they were a little shocked and surprised and sat up and took notice. And some of them, I think, were convinced that this was significant historical material.
Mm. Speaking with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, she is the 300th anniversary professor of history at Harvard University. She is also the author of many books, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning A Midwife's Tale. She'll be delivering the Sterling M. McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture, titled Remember Me, The Inscription of Self in 19th Century Mormonism. That's happening tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, August 24th, here at the Salt Lake City Main Library. It's free and open to the public, and you can also listen to it live here on KCPW or at kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Why do you keep a journal of your day-to-day activities? What do you hope will become of these records? 801-355-TALK is the number to call. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking with the celebrated historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She is the author of A Midwife's Tale, Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History, and other books. She is delivering the McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture, sponsored by the Tanner Humanities Center, tomorrow night, August 24th at 7 o'clock here at the City Library. And you can listen to it live at kcpw.org or right here at 88.3 and 105.3 FM. She's also part of a panel discussion on Saturday morning as part of the Women and the LDS Church conference being held at Fort Douglas at the University of Utah. More information, all the details on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join our conversation, feel free to give us a call. If you've got questions or comments about early record keeping or why you keep records yourself, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, in addition to your interest in early American history, you've also written and spoken quite a bit about Mormon feminism. How do you define that term, Mormon feminism?
Oh my goodness, you don't want to ask hard questions like that. Well,
we've only got a few minutes, so keep it short.
Mormon feminism, it's a phenomenon that some people think is impossible, but that a number of us for about 40 years have been promoting, and it's a belief in equality between men and women, a recognition that there are inequalities that need to be addressed, and a willingness to do something about it.
Can you be a Mormon feminist within this very patriarchal structure of the church, how
sure.
It's organized?
Sure you can, just as you can be a feminist at Harvard University, a very patriarchal institution for many years. We now have a woman president. But in fact, most of the institutions in our society have patriarchal tendencies, and I think any feminist would recognize that. But Mormonism also has some matriarchal tendencies that are very interesting, and also a disposition toward equality and a kind of harmony and working together of all peoples of whatever description. So there's a constant tension, I think, between hierarchical structures and more egalitarian structures. I think that's true of society. And it is very much true of the LDS Church.
Back to your phrase, well-behaved women seldom make history. I mean, do you think that organized religion plays a role in keeping women well-behaved?
It certainly does. But ironically, if we look historically, some of the roots of feminist activism over time, and I'm talking about long periods of time, come out of religion, because religion can be very empowering for individuals. I mean, having a sense that God wants me to do this has given men and women over time the courage to really push back against oppressive structures in their own society. And, you know, in my work, I've written about the conceivably the first historian of women, Christine de Pizan, French woman, a medieval writer, and much of her impetus came from her religious faith. She mined scriptures and the writings of the church fathers to find female heroines and also to find ordinary women who held up society through, you know, they brought the world cloth, for example, or they brought food to the world. So there's no implicit contradiction between religion and feminism. In fact, the long history of religion is full of women who have been outspoken. It's been one of the spaces within which women have been able to assert themselves over time.
Well, there have been moments where throughout the Mormon tradition, women have asserted themselves quite vocally.
Yes.
I sense that is happening again. There are many calls for women to be ordained to the priesthood, to have higher visibility within the church hierarchy. Is this just one of those cycles, or is this a fundamental change in where we are?
Well, you know, I'm
as society.
I'm an old lady. I'm 74 years old. I don't mind admitting to that, and so I sometimes see in the contemporary calls echoes of earlier periods, and you know, some of us think, "Oh my goodness." You know, how come they don't know about these past traditions, the younger women? Sometimes that's one of the dilemmas in feminist history in general, is the loss of history, the loss of continuity in history. And so we have a hard time building on one another because we don't know about those traditions.
So even generationally, you're thinking?
I'm thinking generationally.
20-somethings don't know Glory Steinem.
That's right. They don't know they don't know that women in the LDS Church, to use the Mormon example, once ran hospitals and were in charge of the social services for the institution and took care of adoptions. They don't know that the Relief Society, for example, once managed its own budget and had total control. Some of them don't even know that LDS women were the first in the nation in the modern period to vote, having passed women's suffrage a few weeks after Wyoming, but Utah had the first election. And these women were not passive. They were out agitating for economic opportunities for women and actually helping to create them within their own societies. So there's a wonderful foundation of history. And it's not, I think, to avoid this kind of looping around and simply repeating, the same kind of agendas, we need to build a bit on our own heritage and our own past. Every successful movement has done that.
Well, as a historian, I mean, why do you think some of these elements of the Mormon tradition have been lost? I mean, why are they not being taught to the next generation?
Well, there are lots of reasons for that. There was a huge backlash against feminist stirrings in the 1970s and 80s. There was an institutional effort to, I think, suppress some of those voices. The curriculum had never been totally egalitarian, just as the general historical profession in the U.S. had not fully integrated women's voices. And there just weren't enough people to make this happen. So deliberate suppression, amnesia, and then falling back on tried and true methods of writing history, which tends to be very much top-down and tends to repeat similar kinds of themes. And that's why I think studying history and writing history is so important. It's about the present as well as about the past. History is the one of the ways that people understand themselves and situate themselves in the world, in their society, in their community. And I'm really excited about this conference this weekend, because it's not a conference for Mormons. It's about women in the Latter-day Saint Church, but there's a large community of people interested in LDS history. And they come from all over the country. And the Church Historical Department is partnering with the University of Utah Tanner Humanities Center and with some other local institutions, as I understand it, to sponsor a conference that's going to be lively, it's going to be historical, but it's also going to deal with contemporary issues. It's going to be international, which is a real breakthrough. This is not a story about Utah. This is a global story.
Speaking with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, she is a professor of history at Harvard University, delivering the Sterling McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture, Remember Me, the Inscription of Self in 19th Century Mormonism, happening tomorrow, August 24th at 7 o'clock right here at the Salt Lake City Main Library. It's free and open to the public, and you can listen to it live as well right here on KCPW. And again, the panel discussion that she mentioned is part of the Women and the LDS Church Conference being held at Fort Douglas on Saturday, August 25th. More information at kcpw.org. You mentioned that history is really as much about the past as it is the present. Well, let's talk about this Mormon moment we're in.
Okay.
Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate for president. We've got the Book of Mormon musical, a Broadway hit. We've got polygamists in their own reality TV shows. I mean, what do you make of all of this in the historical context?
Well, it's fascinating, and it keeps a lot of us busy answering emails and doing interviews. It's not new. Mormons have been really hot in the press in a number of periods in time. People are just fascinated. They never seem to get enough of what they think of as a kind of exotic, weird, strange bunch of people, and yet somehow strangely powerful people emerge, like Mitt Romney, who was governor of the state of Massachusetts, where I live for a time. So it's a Mormon moment, but it's also an expose, I think, in somewhat disturbing ways of the continuing polarization of discussion about religion in general. I don't think this is just Mormonism, but it certainly comes out in the way Mormons are treated. People want to talk about magic underwear, for example, and they want to conjure up a lot of amazing stereotypes that some of us thought were buried 100 years ago about conspiracies that might be launched from Salt Lake City, from right here in this spot that other people consider, you know, Zion. So it's an interesting moment for historians. It's a complicated moment for scholars because we tend to look for nuance and complexity, and polarized discussions are hard to come by, I mean, hard to deal with. I mean, you don't know where to begin. And so I'm actually kind of sitting back and watching this and hoping things calm down a bit by the time my book on Mormonism comes out, because it's going to be a nuanced book, probably not a Mormon moment book.
Do you think that the religion, though, is being scrutinized in a different way than when, say, Kennedy came out as the first Catholic candidate? I mean, do you think that the lens is somewhat more glaring on Mormonism, or is it just the way it is, the kind of the ebb and flow that we go through?
Well, I'd have to look more closely at the way things were with Kennedy. Certainly, there's a lot of anti-Catholicism in that period. I remember it from my own childhood. I do think it brings back to an earlier point about the impact of the internet and also of the kind of polarized media that we have now. Everybody sort of has their own special take. There's very little that brings us together in common discussion, so we can't even agree on the facts in a lot of basic policy decisions because we're so fragmented. And I've been rather stunned, actually, at the kind of anonymous comments that are posted on websites and in response to articles, which, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the lack of civility in our culture. I'm an old high school and college debater. I love a good argument. But these are arguments that are really ad hominem attacks. They're not really clarifying. And I really appreciate voices that are trying to get us to calm down and look more seriously at issues, including issues of religion. I mean, it isn't just Mormonism. I mean, the evangelical moment. The emphasis right now on religion as a driving force in politics is something that I think needs serious scrutiny. It disturbs me in a way to see Latter-day Saints participate in this kind of polarized discussion.
Our time is short, but as an expert in studying these microhistories, documents that have been left behind by, you know, ancestors generations ago, I'm just wondering, I mean, you talk about the blogosphere, you talk about some of the incendiary comments that are thrown around on the internet. What kind of records do you think historians are going to look at about our lives today, and what kind of conclusions can they draw from the public discourse swirling around us, both in private diaries as well as, you know, public forums?
Well, let me make two responses to that. The first is that archivists are working very hard to archive exactly these kinds of materials. It's a major issue now for major libraries. How do we document the blogosphere and other kinds of seemingly ephemeral materials? So there are some similarities between diaries and the kinds of things people post on Facebook and other documents. And archiving them is a fascinating problem because some of those materials are ephemeral, that physically ephemeral. I mean, paper is amazingly resilient. Electronics, we're not sure yet. So that's one way to approach it. Another is, I have to admit, having lamented and sounding like, you know, a senior citizen here lamenting the lack of civility, I am also a historian of the American Revolution. And we're not, I mean, Americans have been polarized for a very long time. But, you know, we ended up in a bloody and horrible civil war. We've ended up in terrible carnage. Even in Utah, I mean, massacres, assaults on American Indians, and most of that has been driven, a lot of that has been driven, not just by economic competition, but by the way we represent people who aren't like us. And so I do worry about it. I don't like to see us polarized the way that we are now.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She is a professor at Harvard University of History, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, as well as a MacArthur Genius Grant Fellow. She will be delivering the lecture, Remember Me, the Inscription of Self in 19th Century Mormonism, tomorrow, August 24th at 7 o'clock, right here at the Salt Lake City Main Library. It's sponsored by the Tanner Humanities Center at the University of Utah. It's free and open to the public, and you can listen live on KCPW. And Dr. Ulrich, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Coming up next, another perspective from a contemporary Mormon feminist, Joanna Brooks. But first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. As a child, Joanna Brooks often felt like a root beer amongst the Coca-Colas, an outsider because of her LDS faith. Still, she embraced the faith with gusto until she went to college. She matured and began to struggle with some of the religion's tenets. Faith became more complicated. Brooks explains the everyday experience of being Mormon in a new memoir. And today on the program, she joins us to share her journey from innocence to exile to faith on her own terms. Joanna Brooks joins me in studio. Joanna, great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, Jennifer, thank you.
Joanna Brooks will be speaking about her new book, The Book of Mormon Girl, a memoir of American faith. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at Weller Bookworks, 607 Trolley Square here in Salt Lake City. But we invite you to join us if you've got questions or comments about Joanna's work, about her particular journey. You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Joanna, you're a professor. You're an academic. You are a professor at San Diego State University. Did you ever think that you'd be talking about your life and your faith on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart?
You know, it's true. It's been quite a ride, and it all owes to Mitt Romney and this Mormon moment. But, you know, as a literature professor, I grew up as a Mormon girl loving books, loving to read. I was taught from the time I was young that it mattered, learning, studying the scriptures, and I became just a giant reader. And as a literature professor, I studied memoirs from every conceivable American culture, African-American culture, American-Indian culture. But when I'd go to the bookstore on the Mormon shelf, there were so few stories about how it actually felt to grow up an ordinary Mormon girl, you know, our lives and their complexities, the funny and tender aspects of our faith, and the real challenges Mormons face. So that's what I tried to do with this book.
In your memoir, you do describe yourself as a root beer among the Cokes. I mean, how did that otherness, you know, that distinction shape your faith and your interactions with other kids?
And I had a different experience than maybe a lot of your listeners who are LDS, because I grew up in Southern California. And I grew up with a really robust Mormon community. I grew up in a very observant Mormon household. But we were a very small minority. And so I was always the only Mormon kid in my class at school. You know, you'd enter the room and look around for who are the other Mormons, you know. And that sense of difference conveyed a great sense of responsibility to me. I felt really responsible to be an example of my faith. And it's shaped my life since then, too. I still feel a responsibility to tell my part of the Mormon story, to share the beauty and the human side of the faith with an audience.
In the book, you write that you grew up idolizing Donnie and Marie Osmond. especially Marie. And you have trotted into the studio Marie Osmond's book on personal health care.
Yes, it's the Marie Osmond Guide to Beauty, Health, and Style. I got it when I was about 12 years old. Marie was my role model because you know what? She was an ambitious, spunky, dark-haired Mormon girl with a television studio of her own. Irresistible.
But, I mean, how did that role model change you in any way? Did it?
I mean, well, I write in the book, you know, it's one of the most comedic chapters in the book and one that everyone, you know, so many women from different backgrounds have told me they can identify with, because here I am as a 12-year-old Mormon girl trying to figure out how to attain this mystery of womanhood, how to get there and be like my idol Marie, who is, you know, shown in pictures in the guide at BYU, surrounded by cute guys with a perfect outfit. And so studying the page, and I'm 12 and I don't have a penny to my name. I don't even have access to like the department store to buy the clothes she's talking about. I have nothing. So trying to figure out how to be this perfect example of womanhood, that's not only a Mormon story, that's a very human story about growing up.
Mm. Speaking with Joanna Brooks, she's an award-winning scholar of religion and American culture, the author or editor of 5 books. She's been featured on NPR, CNN, the BBC, other places. Her writings appeared in the Washington Post, among other spots. And she's also an associate professor and chair of the Department of English and Comparative Literature at San Diego State University. Her new memoir is titled The Book of Mormon Girl, and she'll be speaking about that book tonight, August 23rd, at 7 o'clock at Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. More details at kcpw.org. It's interesting that the questions about your faith really did sprout at that liberal bastion, Brigham Young University.
People don't know the place is lousy with Democrats. Quietly.
I mean, what were some of the religious tenets that really started to spawn some questions in your mind, kind of break your childhood innocent faith?
You know, in the book I talk about, you know, I attended BYU. I came in 89. And by the time I was a sophomore, the Gulf War was happening. And so, you know, as a sort of idealistic college student reading at BYU great books of world literature, world religion, you know, I began to think of the world as a more complicated place. And I remember thinking, maybe I'm kind of anti-war, you know, kind of normal for a 20-year-old to sort of experiment after grew up in such a conservative background. And I pinned a little peace sign button to my backpack, and I recount walking along the icy sidewalks to campus and someone driving by in a passing car and yelling the word Antichrist at me, you know, for being sort of maybe anti-war. And so, you know, at BYU, I found both the richness of our faith. There is, as you know, Laurel Ulrich was talking about just in the segment for this one, a tradition of Mormon progressivism. And there's also a rigid conservatism. And I found both right there in the heart of the culture at BYU.
Well, you did find some arguments with the church in its orthodoxy. You spent some time, as you call it, in exile from the church. And you say that you wore your faith under your clothing. What do you mean by that?
Well, there were, you know, in Mormon history, there have been difficult years for progressive Mormon women and men. And, you know, when I was 21, there were excommunications of several prominent feminists and intellectuals, and that really impacted me. I hung on. I kept going to church. I kept trying. But after a while, I found that I would just sort of cry every time I went to church, feeling unsure if there was a place for me in a faith that I cared about very deeply. So I sort of pulled into myself and took a few years and didn't go to church and never stopped feeling entirely Mormon. Still felt it to my bones, to my core. That's a story I hear from Mormon, from all kinds of Mormon people. Gay, straight, all over the political map. It's something we carry very close to us, no matter if we have disagreements or questions or not.
But why didn't you just reject that part of your identity, that Mormon part?
Drill it out of my bones.
Yeah, I mean, so many people who are disaffected with the church can walk away.
That's true.
Will walk away. Why did you cling to that, even in your absence of regular church attendance?
You know, it felt still like home to me. It was so deeply formative of me from the time I was a child, my faith. And I'd had really powerful and positive spiritual experiences within the context of Mormonism. And I couldn't walk away from those, even if I had to wrestle to come to terms with my own way of living with my faith and my conscience intact. So I held on. I held on. And I hear that story from so many people. It doesn't have to be just a Mormon story. People raised Christian, people raised Jewish. You know, how do you make sense of a faith tradition that teaches you wonderful things, but that also has hard parts as well?
You eventually married outside of the faith, a nice Jewish boy.
True.
What does he make of your struggle with your faith tradition? I mean, does he struggle with his own faith in a similar way?
See, Jewish people, they've been at this for thousands of years. So they're like, okay, there will be some disagreements. It's sort of a Jewish way of life, you know. One thing I've learned from being in my husband's world of religion, he's a Reform Jew, which is a very progressive sort of American, you know, variant of Judaism, you know, is that arguments are okay in a community. Arguments can be a sign of respect for a tradition. Questions are powerful, sometimes even more powerful than you know, stable answers. And I've seen in Judaism the ability for people to find different places on an orthodoxy spectrum and still have love and respect for a faith tradition that gives their meanings comfort and structure and hope. So those have been fantastic lessons that my husband's faith has brought into my own life. Plus, he's cute and has a good sense of humor, which helps.
You're raising your daughters as both Mormon and Jewish. Seems a little complicated. How's it going?
It is always complicated raising kids, isn't it? We are an interfaith family, and most interfaith families are counseled or have in recent times to choose one. And that just didn't feel possible for us. He loves his Judaism. I love my Mormonism. We both may be unorthodox, but we both have felt an obligation to give our children an education in both faith traditions and then to expect them to make adult choices like all children have to grow up and make adult choices about the faith. It's complicated. It's complicated, but we're hopeful.
One painful episode that you describe in your book was the LDS Church's support for California's Prop 8. Which defined marriage as between a man and a woman. You actively opposed this proposition, whereas church members, particularly in your hometown in California, were strongly pushed to support it, both ideologically and financially. How are you thinking about social issues within the church today?
You know, I think this is a really powerful moment for rank-and-file Mormon people. You know, there have always been gay Mormons. There have always been gay Mormons. We've always had gay children in our families, gay cousins, gay relatives, gay spouses. And, you know, finally, there is a degree of growing openness in the way we talk about gay issues. And, you know, for the wonderful example of the church-attending Mormons who participated in the Pride Parade this year, I think shows a willingness to think about that message of love that should be core to faith and how to implement that in our congregations, in our families, around gay issues, just so that there's more space for understanding, more space for compassion and reconciliation, a little less circling the wagons and raising the swords, and a little more listening and sorting things out together. And that gives me a lot of hope.
I want to put a similar question that I put to Dr. Ulrich about this Mormon moment. I mean, the Mitt Romney thing,
right.
The polygamy thing, the Book of Mormon musical. What do you make of all of it?
Yeah, it's quite a time. I loved Laurel's perspective that this isn't the first Mormon moment. Oh, no. There is an endless curiosity. I think it's fed as well by the 24-hour digital media cycle where there's this constant demand for content. The media needs things to talk about all the time. And few things are more interesting and curious than this homegrown American faith that drives such loyalty from its members that we are in the spin cycle. And the outsider curiosity, I think, has started some conversations within the faith that may eventually lead us to being a bit more open about our beliefs and about our practices. That would be a good thing.
Just got about a minute left, but why did you tell this story? I mean, why a memoir?
You know, I I chose to tell this story in the hopes that by putting my own story, my own very human, very imperfect story out there, it would create space for other Mormons to tell their stories as well. Oftentimes we feel ashamed in Mormon culture to tell stories that aren't orthodox, that aren't perfect. I'm certainly not perfect. This is just a story about how it really feels, tender, funny, sad, being a Mormon girl. And I hope that through this book, non-Mormons will come to see us as human as well.
Are you a real Mormon?
What does that mean?
I want to ask you.
A real Mormon? I belong to the church. I attend church. I observe the rules. So, yeah, I feel like a real Mormon. But, you know, isn't it funny? Mormons always ask each other that question. Mormon. Are you really a Mormon? You know, Jews don't say that to each other.
Joanna Brooks, award-winning scholar of religion and American culture, the author of 5 books, including her latest memoir, The Book of Mormon Girl. Joanna Brooks will be reading from her book tonight, August 23rd at 7 o'clock at Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. And Joanna Brooks, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And coming up tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Representative Jim Matheson will be on the program, so tune in for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.